It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and today for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk with a chef and public television personality about the best of Italian cooking and ways we can do it easily at home.
But first, the nation's leading heart health organizations have released new guidelines that would change the way doctors assess and treat cardiovascular risk.
About a quarter of Americans over age 45 already take cholesterol-lowering statin drugs. Under the new guidelines, that number could grow a lot as the focus shifts from bad cholesterol levels to other risk factors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. What do you think of these new guidelines? You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Joining us now to discuss these new guidelines is Dr. Patrick McBride. He is a professor of medicine and associate director of the Preventive Cardiology Program at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. He also served on the panel that developed the new guidelines. Dr. McBride, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to start with the need for the new guidelines in the first place. What led to this process, and how long have these guidelines been in development?
We spent the last 5 years reviewing all the evidence and developed these guidelines very carefully. The need for the new guidelines is based on a number of things. The last guidelines came out 12 years ago, and there's been lots of new research and lots of new evidence we felt was very important to include in the new guidelines, as well as a major shift in the health of the American population. You know, there's been a very dramatic increase in the incidence of overweight and obesity, as well as a big shift in the diversity of our population with a far greater number of people at risk.
So the headlines that we have been seeing since these guidelines came out yesterday have to do with the amount of people who might wind up taking statins as a result of this. But talk a little bit about the process of arriving at some of these conclusions. I mean, it took 5 years to get here. Are you pretty happy with the way things came out?
Well, the major risk that we talked about was making sure the appropriate people got on the medication. I'm very happy with the conclusions because they were very carefully thought out. What we did was took a great deal of time to make sure that we looked at all of the evidence, both the pros and the cons, the benefits and the risks of treatment for all different types of cholesterol treatment and all the people who could be candidates. So we wanted to be very sure that we looked, made sure the right people got on treatment. You know, the population's aging with the aging of baby boomers, and we were trying to make sure that we found that the people that were at greatest risk got on treatment. So, in fact, for clinicians, the guidelines changed very subtly, and we tried to make things much simpler than the previous guidelines. We still made sure that clinicians estimated a person's risk before they started treatment. But we eliminated a lot of laboratory tests after they went on treatment. We made sure that patients got on treatment. The best news is that almost all of these cholesterol medicines now are generic and inexpensive. And so from a cost-benefit point of view, they're very cost-beneficial.
And I read, there have been a lot of articles on this, of course, but there was a quote in Forbes that caught my eye. And I'm just going to read it to you, and I'd like to get your reaction to it. The huge shift in thinking here is the idea that you don't take a cholesterol drug or a blood pressure medication to fix your high cholesterol or high blood pressure, but to lower your risk of having a heart attack or stroke. Does that sound about right to you?
Sort of.
Okay.
So it depends. You know, all people can't be treated equally here because there are people that inherit cholesterol problems, and those cholesterol problems need to be treated, you know, to lower their cholesterol or improve their cholesterol. And then there are people with multiple risk factors. So people who have diabetes and high blood pressure and are overweight and who have had a heart attack or who have other risk factors. And when they take cholesterol medicine, for example, who have a moderately or modestly elevated cholesterol, they're getting a number of benefits, including some things like inflammation. So it may be a little less about their cholesterol as about reducing risk. So it really depends on the person. And that's why, in the end, the decision about treatment is a decision between the patient and their doctor.
And as I understand it, and you've addressed this a little bit, but the risk factors we're talking about are much more than just, you know, here are your cholesterol numbers, we're going to prescribe a statin for you. They're taking a lot of other factors into account. You mentioned genetic predisposition and so forth.
Yeah, that's what's really important. You know, what I've seen in a lot of the press and what I've heard on radio and television is a lot of general sweeping statements. And the paper that came along with our cholesterol guidelines is a risk assessment paper. And what it does is it says take you and evaluate your overall risk, your family's history, your genetics, your behaviors, your risk factors for heart disease, and make an individualized decision for you and about your risk in the next 10 years and your risk in a lifetime, and decide if the treatment is something that might be useful to you. And then it says what your risk and benefits are. And then you and your doctor can decide, because it's very different. So what I've read in a lot of news reports is a person should or shouldn't do that. That's really harmful to have a statement like that, because for somebody with heart disease, that's a bad statement, or somebody with diabetes, or somebody with a genetic cholesterol disorder, they should be getting treatment, because our evidence is very powerful about that, that it's a great benefit to them. So those are decisions that shouldn't be made in a newspaper, but should be made in the doctor's office.
And the other big headline that I've been seeing anyway has to do with the number of people who might wind up taking some of these medicines as a result of these new guidelines. I don't remember the exact figures, but the number is very substantial hike. Does that sound right to you as well, that we might wind up as a result of these new guidelines seeing a lot more people taking these sort of statin medications and that sort of thing?
No. So I've looked at some of this arithmetic too. You know, as a panel, we did some of these estimates. And there should be some more people that are on cholesterol medicines, that's for sure, because there are so many high-risk people out there that aren't seeking appropriate medical care. As we know, we've got over 50 million uninsured people in the country that don't have access. And so, of course, there are some high-risk people out there that should be on treatment. And there are people that aren't following with their doctor regularly. There are people on treatment that are very low-risk that shouldn't be. So these medicines, in some doctors' view, are so good that I think they have some low-risk people on them. What we're really trying to clarify in this guideline is who are the right people, the most appropriate people for treatment. And, yeah, these are very safe and very effective treatment, contrary to some reports, because our evidence was clear about that. And there are certainly people that get side effects from some of these medications, but that percentage is quite low. And this guideline will suggest that there'll be more people on them, but not some of the numbers we've seen thrown about the media.
And so I have to ask, though, where are the, because I got to tell you, I read a bunch of articles and almost everyone said that, you know, they focused very heavily on this. Are they just not reading the entire report and just cherry picking stuff out of it?
You know, it's partly true and partly not, because we know, and when you look at the scientific evidence, that most people that have heart disease and diabetes these days, fortunately, are getting treatment or at least offered it. But a lot of them aren't. So that's a group that more people should be on treatment. We know most of the people that are at moderate to high risk of heart disease that haven't had a heart attack or stroke yet aren't being offered treatment. So that's certainly a group that there'll be more people on treatment. But there are some low-risk people on treatment that don't need to be. And so we want to reduce those people.
We've got a caller who would like to join in. Scott is with us now from Highland. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I've heard this all over the news today, and honestly, I'm a little angry because, well, first of all, I'm 51 years old, and I had stents 5 years ago, and so I've been doing a lot of research on my own, trying to find out what studies are out there and whatnot, and it seems like your recommendations here are not talking much about diet, and, you know, diet is the key to health. It's all, what it seems to me on the surface is let's find a way just to give drugs to everybody and kind of bypass the problem in the first place.
Scott, thanks for the call. Let's let Dr. McBride take a crack at that.
Well, there's a full comprehensive report that accompanies our report that is on diet and lifestyle. It's a lifestyle report. It talks about physical activity and weight and diet, so very comprehensive. And we make a very clear point that that's a key and that's the first step. For somebody like our caller, though, that's had heart disease and stents, there's very strong evidence that a person like that should be on these cholesterol-lowering medicines, the statins, because it makes a really big difference. They're complementary. So somebody can't be on one of these medicines and have poor nutrition or not be exercising or taking care of themselves. They go hand in hand. And that's why our reports go hand in hand.
So as we look ahead, I mean, these guidelines are brand new. When do you start working on the next set of guidelines? Is that work that starts right now, or do you wait and see for a couple of years how these go and then go from there?
Well, generally, we wait to see when there's enough new evidence. You know, if there are new studies, new treatments, then we say then there's enough information together that we ought to reconvene. So we'd probably wait a few years for more good scientific information. You know, one other point the caller makes is a lot of people try to do their own research. Unfortunately, you know, the Internet is full of so much misinformation that it's hard to get really good, sound scientific information unless somebody is an expert at it. So that's what this panel did, was use really sound methods to get the best information, good science. And so I think it's a really good resource for the public as well as professionals.
And if people want to take a look at the guidelines for themselves, because it sounds as though you are encouraging people to actually take a look at these things, where's a good place for them to go and get a look at these guidelines?
Go to American Heart Association's website, which is heart.org. It's a site that really puts things together very well for both the public and professionals. It's a really great resource.
Well, Dr. McBride, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Appreciate your time. Dr. Patrick McBride has been with us. He is a professor of medicine and the associate director of the Preventive Cardiology Program at the University of Wisconsin Medical School.
Coming up next, the host of Lydia's Italy joins us to talk about some common sense Italian cooking.
You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network.
I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time.
Getting cold here in Wisconsin. It already has been cold up in the northern part of the state, and that means one thing for a lot of people, comfort food.
And I have to tell you, it's been a little cold down here in the south, too, and for a lot of people, that comfort food means Italian food. Simple, hearty recipes that fill the belly and warm the soul. So what's your favorite Italian recipe? Do you have any questions that you would like to ask about how to become a great Italian cook? You can call in and ask our expert about your favorite Italian dish or maybe a recipe that's been passed down through the generations. 800-642-1234 or email us talk@wpr.org.
Lydia Bastianich joins us now. She's a chef, public TV personality, author, restaurateur. Her new book is Lydia's Common Sense Italian Cooking. She co-wrote that with her daughter. She's the host of Lydia's Italy in America, which can be seen on public television. Check your local listings for the time. Lydia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Rob, Gene, buonasera.
Buonasera. So where does you love cooking, and where does that come from in the first place?
God, I think ever since I can't remember. Yeah, I have a great time cooking. I love it. It's my profession. It's my passion. I think that it really sort of started from my very formative years. I was in a situation, my mother was a teacher, so she would be in the city and teaching. And I was about 2 kilometers away from the city in a little town with Grandma. And Grandma had this wonderful courtyard, that's where we lived. And in the courtyard, there were pens, there were chickens, there were geese, ducks. We had rabbits, we had goats, we had pigs. And I remember milking the goats and the warm milk I drank. We made olive oils. And so I remember tasting the olive oil. We made wine, the seasonal of the vegetable garden, the tomatoes, eggplant in the summer, the sweet peas in the springtime, the ripe figs in the fall. So I think that, you know, and I was very much involved. Grandma would send me, go get the eggs from the chicken, nice warm eggs. I would bring them down. We would make pasta. We would make bread. And then go and sort of get some basil, go get some rosemary. And I would run out, get it, bring it back, and I would smell like a rosemary because there were those big, big bushes. And, I think that all of those kind of really flavors, really genuine flavors from the earth stayed with me. And through my life, you know, I was trying, because then life has taken me on. We migrated. We actually left. I left grandma behind. In a sense, I wasn't even aware that I was not going to go back because I was a young lady. And I think all of that kind of stood in me, those moments, and I wanted to capture them, and I wanted to cook those flavors forever.
Now, your new book is called The Common Sense Italian Cooking, and you've got that great quote in this book that common sense is anything but common. Can you talk a little bit about this idea of common sense cooking, and what does that mean, really?
Well, you know, I get often from people, you know, I get a lot of emails, and this insecurity in the kitchen. People feel like, oh, no, they can't take food is something alien. Oh, I can't cook. And it's far, you know, distant from that, actually. We all have a way with cooking. But I think if one could just release and use one's common sense in the kitchen, it would make it that much easier. So you take a recipe, of course, and you follow it somewhat or whatever. But then use your common sense. You know, if you don't have peas, you might have lima beans. If you don't have rosemary, you might have sage. You know, and kind of this letting loose in the kitchen and letting your common sense and the feeling of, you know, I can do this. I have the sensibility. And I think a lot of people don't look in themselves for that sensibility. They have it. So I want to bring it out. I want to highlight it for them. I want to empower them that they're in the kitchen and they're the boss of the kitchen. Relax, let loose. Yes, if you're not really familiar, get some recipes to guide you, but make it happen in the kitchen.
So how did we get to this point where that idea of common sense, of taking a chance, how have we lost that?
I think because everything has been, you know, I guess in the last 20, 30 years, you know, big industry wants to prepare everything for us, wants to make life so easy for us, you know. Women are at work, women maybe should be out at work, and yes, that's a great place to be, but, you know, why shouldn't we cook as well? Men are cooking today, you know. So I think that maybe big industry has provided a lot of those kind of skipping the logistics of food. We get something in a plastic, wrapped in a plastic, bring it home, put it in a microwave, it's done. And I think that deprives us, it deprives our family, it deprives the children. I think the children are so far removed from really the source of food. So we need to get back into the basics. We need to get close to the earth, meaning close to the products as they are given to us by the earth, by whoever produces. I mean, you know, if the chicken and whatever, all of that. We need to get it in our hands, and we need to understand it. And then a kind of a common sensibility will come right out. You know, you will know what to do, in a sense. You know, you know if the chicken is slippery, or there's too much fat, or there's too much skin. You know, just cut it off, pat it dry. You know, put some salt on it and marinate it. Let it marinate. You know, this kind of little sensibility. And then when you have a whole chicken, all those bones and the wings and all of that, once you have used your breast and the legs and all of that, put it in the pot with some leftover celery stems, parsley stems, a little bit of the tips of the onions. All of that you put in the pot with some water, with some chicken bones. You got yourself a soup. You know, this kind of. Sensibility relating to the product, relating to the earth, and you kind of understand, you protect. It's even, you know, we're so concerned about the environment, but this is one way we can really sort of respect the environment.
That's another point you bring up. In addition to saving those chicken bones to make soup stock, what can we do? We've got that old dried out bread. I might throw it away, but I can maybe do something with it, right?
You can do 1,000 things with it. I would just, exactly. So, you know, that bread that's left over, you know, there's nothing worse than throwing food away. I think it's a sin, a big sin. And so, with the leftover bread, you can make a nice fruit pudding, a pear pudding. I have in this book, it's a pear pudding. This is the season of pears. All you need is eggs, whisk eggs, a little bit of cream, that bread that you have left over, some pears in there, some sugar, maybe some vanilla, and you bake it. How hard is that? Now, the common sense comes in here, but if I can do that with pears, why can't I do that with apples? Why can't I do that with apricots? And so on down the line. That's what I'm talking about, you know, really relating. Yes, maybe using a guidance, a recipe, but then kind of using your common sense to make that recipe your own. But with old bread, certainly making breadcrumbs, that's the simplest. But there's soups you could be make. You add the old bread to a vegetable soup. And it's, in Italian, it's called ribollita, which means reboiled. So you have a nice, dense vegetable soup. You add some of that old bread, and you reboil it once more. The bread kind of breaks into little pieces and densens that soup up, and it's delicious.
Oh, man, I'm getting hungry here. We are talking to Lydia Bastianich. She's a chef, public TV personality. Her new book is Lydia's Common Sense Italian Cooking.
And what questions do you have about Italian cooking? As you can hear, we've got an expert on the line. And if you've got a favorite Italian dish you'd like to share or ask about, let us know. Or maybe a recipe that's been passed down through the generations of your family. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or drop us an email, talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up later on in the program, we'll hear about one of the last surviving Navajo-American code talkers from World War II.
Now we continue our conversation about Italian cooking with Lydia Bastianich. She's a chef. She's on public TV. She's got a new book. It's Lydia's Common Sense Italian Cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about Italian cooking or your favorite recipes. We'll go straight to the phones. We've got Bill on the line in Duluth. Bill, hi. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hi, Lydia. Are you there?
Hi, Bill. How you doing?
Good. I'm a big fan. My wife and I watched you for a long time. We love what you've taught us. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for watching. And what is your question, Bill?
You're wonderful. Well, excuse me. We seem to have a debate in our family, and is when you're boiling your water to cook your noodles or your pasta, you know, I've seen my dad often pour olive oil in there, and I think that you taught us not to do that now, but I didn't correct him the last time he did it, but I think if I remember that makes the oils noodle oily and doesn't allow the pasta to stick. Am I right or is he right?
You got that right, Bill. Absolutely. When you boil pasta, dry pasta for that matter, even fresh pasta, abundant water, salt, yes, because that kind of gives that little flavoring to the pasta, but absolutely no oil because the oil coats the pasta, and as you said, the sauce does not adhere to the pasta, and the pasta gets very slippery. Also, do not rinse your pasta. The best way is you put your pasta in the water, you cook it, you look at the timing. I like mine a little bit al dente, pull it out a little bit before it is cooked, and then you pull it out. You can drain it, but don't wash it, or you can just fish it out like I do and put it right in the sauce. And so that the pasta has a little sticky, the sauce adheres to the pasta, but also the pasta finishes cooking in the sauce, absorbs the sauce in, and is that much better. One word of caution, do not over-sauce it. So take half of the sauce, put it in the pan, put the pasta in there, dress it, and then you add the sauce as you need it.
Wow. Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, Bill.
Yeah, Bill, thanks for that call. And one of the questions I'd like to ask, you know, we heard Bill's question, and Lydia, I'm wondering if you, and it seems kind of basic, but are these the kinds of questions that real cooks have, you know, the real basic, how do you do X and Y? Because what we're talking about here is not rocket science exactly.
Exactly. These are the sort of the basic know-hows in the kitchen, the basic techniques of cooking, and then you apply it from there, and then you use your common sense. You heard me explain why. From here on, you know, it's your piece of information, and you can use it in whatever you do, sort of cooking pasta, putting it in the sauce, getting it more flavorful, undercooking it. You can do that with any recipe.
We'll go back to the phones now. We've got Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Camille, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Camille.
Hi, Lydia. I would like to ask you what the key is to a good panettone, one that isn't too dry, you know, soft and moist. Yeah.
Do you make the panettone, or are you buying it?
No, not to buy it. I would love to make it. I tried once a couple of years ago, and it wasn't, the consistency wasn't so great.
Yeah, it looks simple, but it's a very difficult process.
Let me stop you, Lydia. I don't know what a panettone is. Let's start at ground zero here.
Okay, panna is bread, but panettone is a kind of tall mushroom-looking like bread that's usually wrapped in cellophane, and it is sweet bread that has candied fruits in there. And it is always used in Italy for the holidays, specifically for Christmas and for the New Year's. Now, this goes way back, you know, when people were not as into sweets as we are now. And when the holidays came around, they had dried fruits that they saved from the summer, and they would turn the regular bread, add some more butter, add some more eggs, and add this candied fruit, and they would turn it into the sweetbread panettone for the festivities. So, now Camille, to go back, that's not an easy, because for a good panettone, you need to raise it, let it rise at least 6 to 7 times. And that is because it is rich in butter and it is rich in eggs, and that's what gives it the moisture. So it's all about kneading. Get yourself a good recipe. This is, you know, about technique. So get yourself a good recipe, and then you knead it well. If yours is very dry, I would say it really needs either more eggs or a little bit more butter, the liquid butter. You know, you sort of liquefy your butter and you add it. And then what happens is, because these are kind of dense elements that you're adding heavy, you have to let it rise. You have to let it rise about 6-7 times and make the mass on the soft side. Don't make it very dense. Make it on the soft side, and then you put it in a form, you know, in that kind of tubular form, and the mass rises up and it makes that cap almost like a mushroom cap on top of it. Does that help you, Camille?
Yeah. You say that if it's too dry, to add probably more eggs, maybe more butter.
Exactly.
But is there a place I could find a recipe to start with that you would consider a good recipe? There are lots of recipes online,
okay.
But...
Yeah, I'll give you a website. You go there, you ask me this question, and we will send you a recipe. So it is www.lydiasitaly.com.
All right. Good luck,
okay.
Camille. I want to get on to another caller here. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, and before we get to the caller, I want to ask a quick question. You know, a couple of years ago, 5-10 years ago, bread machines, pasta machines, they were all the rage. And it seems like people needed these sorts of accessories to make food. In your book, you talk about, you know, you can make your own pasta. You can make your own pizza dough. And it gets back to that common sense thing. Is there a feeling now that people have to have a lot of accessories, you know, in order to make food?
Again, that is the industry, you know, trying to capitalize on fads and interests, and of course making facilitate that with an instrument or machine, and it works. But it's, you know, you can go to basics and do just the same, if not even better, with the basic tools. That is your hands, starting with your hands. So you can knead a great bread with your hand or great pasta. I think that a food processor is a great element, or a mixer with a dough hook. It's a great help in really kneading the bread dough well, and also in kneading pasta. So if you want to make pasta, you know, you have a food processor, all you put in there is flour, eggs, and a little bit of water, and you got yourself pasta. And you just let it whirl for 4 or 5 minutes. So it really does facilitate things.
Let's go back to the phones right now. We've got a call from Marty, who joins us from Bennett. Hi.
Well, good afternoon. Hello, Lydia. How nice
Hi, Marty.
To talk to you. Hello. Say, this has nothing to do with anything you've been talking about, but when else am I ever going to be able to ask you this question? My husband and I were just in Rome. We were there for 10 days. We were all over the city. We ate everywhere. And I confess, we were on a budget, but we only had about 2 good meals the whole time we were there. So my question is the quality of restaurants in Rome diminishing, or do you really only, can you only eat well there if you have lots and lots of money?
No, it's just you can eat well. But, you know, Rome is a tourist city. So is Venice. So is Florence. and inevitably you will find this opportunistic operators. So the question is to come sort of do a little research before and find those places that fit your budget and that have good rating from people that have been there, that tasted it. And secondly, you know, sometimes you go in the market, or I usually do that, especially I ask the salespeople, you know, where do you have lunch? Where can, you know, and sometimes they will give you good indication in those little trattorias, osterias that maybe just offer three plates for lunch are the best way to go. I love that. So, you know, it's not always about money and high prices. That is an experience as well. But you can get some good food in Italy in the little trattorias, but you have to know which ones, absolutely.
I have a question that comes from across the board from me. Our board operator, Michelle, is hoping you can give her some great ways to cook eggplant.
Oh, eggplant. Eggplant is a great vegetables to cook. Of course, again, cook it in the summer, now into the fall. I think eggplant is just about over now. So, you know, stay within season and buy the right eggplant. So what are you looking for? A nice, firm eggplant that has a nice long stem that is still green. Stay away from eggplants that have big bellies, because that will be an indication that it has a lot of seeds. Mm. And seeds, you know, that means tannin. That means that astringent, pungent flavor in eggplant with the tannin. So once you have chosen the right eggplant, the second step is to slice it and put it under salt a little bit to really remove if there is any of that sort of bitterness. And once you have removed that, you put it and you let it stay there for about 20 minutes with some weight on. Then you rinse it off, you pat it dry, and then you proceed. Of course, you know, frying the eggplant, either just flour or bread and flour, it's one way, it's delicious. But today we're all conscious about how much fat and weight. But frying it, you'll get maximum of flavor, no question about it. Once it's fried, you can make it into sandwiches. You can make it a parmigiana from there. You fry it, and then you layer it with some cheese, with some tomato sauce, and you put it in the oven. You have yourself a great parmigiana. Also, once you fry the eggplant slice, a nice large slice with just flour, you can stuff it with ricotta or mozzarella and make like the rollatini, like rolled eggplant, and then you put it in the oven, you bake it, and that's another great dish. But you can also chop eggplants in little cubes now, once you have washed it and drained it, and put it in tomato sauce and let it cook in there so it doesn't have to be fried. And you let it cook in there, it makes a great tomato sauce with eggplant in it. You can do that with meat sauce plus eggplant. Baking eggplants, another version. You take the eggplant, even the smaller eggplants, and you can kind of cut it almost like a fan. You cut the eggplant in half, and then you fan the eggplant, open the fans up, and you put some tomatoes, some cheese in there, season it, and you put it with a little bit of tomato sauce in the oven, and you get like the whole half of eggplant bake. So it's endless what you can do with eggplant.
We're talking to Chef Lydia Bastianich. She is the author of the new book, Lydia's Common Sense Italian Cooking. Still a few minutes for your questions at 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. We pick up our conversation now with Lydia Bastianich, author of Lydia's Common Sense Italian Cooking. Lydia, one of the things I loved about your book, in addition to saying we should use common sense, you say we should use all five senses as we cook. What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. You know, we learn with all our senses. We communicate with our senses. Let's use it in cooking. So what I mean by that is that, you know, visual. It's important when you buy things, when you cook, the color will tell you, you know, is it burnt? Is it ready? Is the vegetables overcooked? So, you know, look at things. Smelling is an extremely important sense in cooking. I mean, it will tell you, is the fish bad? Is the fish good? Is the meat bad? Is it burning? Is it, you know, even is it too acidic? You know, does it have the perfumes or the spice? Is it floral enough in what you want? And, you know, we collect information, of course, with all of our senses. That's collecting our smells, you know, in our memories of the food that we ate, that we loved, the kind of the smell comes back when you're cooking. Ah, this, I remember that dish. It was so delicious. So use those reference points that of things that you have stored in your memory that have been collected by your senses. And also, you know, when you really something, you like something, and you take that smell and you file it away so that the next time you have it, tactile, touching things. I mean, I love touching food. It speaks to me. Food talks to me when I touch it. I know if meat is tough. I know if the chicken is slippery and slimy. I know if fish is fresh when I press down on it. A celery rib, you know, is fresh, and so on. So all of those elements, you know, use your hand to touch it, and so it is important. All of those, even the auditory, the listening. You know, I could be maybe at the sink, and I hear that something is crackling at the stove. I know I'm at the very bottom of the pot, and something's going to stick soon if I don't get back to it quickly. So identify those sounds, recognize them, and let them guide you. You know, your common sense. In a sense, collect all of this in what under the heading of common sense and use it in cooking.
You know, listening to this conversation and just talking, you know, using your senses, talking about locally sourced food, all of those things, it just seems to me, as we've been talking for the last half hour or so, that this is a really good time in history to be a cook and to be interested in food.
I think, you know, you see the explosion between the television shows. Now, I started my PBS show about 15 years ago. I did my first shows with Julia Child, and then I went on. But now, you know, I mean, station after station dedicated to the art or the showmanship or the sensationalism of cooking, whatever you want to call it. But nonetheless, there's a tremendous interest in cooking. And I think people are realizing how important really food is, not only to feed us, but it is so important to communicate. It's a social conduit, if you will. It nurtures us. The attention to food and eating well and being healthy, being fit. And I think that people are beginning to realize that cooking is an act of love for the people that, you know, you want somebody to enjoy it, to feel well, to be good. You know, with that plate, you know I do that. You know, I feel like, oh, I'm bringing you this plate because I want you to feel good, because I want you to grow well, and so on. So I think that a lot of parents are feeling that and are getting involved. And as I said before, men are really heading to the kitchen, and I love that.
In our last minute, Lydia, what's for dinner tonight? What are you planning on making?
Well, you know, I think I'm going to make a little. I had a lunch with a business lunch, and I think I'm going to make just a little spaghetti, garlic, and oil with parsley. How's that?
Keep it nice and simple. I love it. Well, Lydia, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Lydia Bastianich. She's a chef, a TV personality. You can catch her on public TV. Check for local listings. She's an author. Her newest book is Lydia's Common Sense Italian Cooking. She's the host of Lydia's Italy in America, by the way. That's her newest show. This is Central Time.